This session is called Innovations in Mindfulness, Resilience, and Total Health. You already know who I am, so we don't need a second introduction. And but what I want to do is introduce our three panelists in just a moment. But first I want to start with some thoughts about this particular session. This is a hard, tough act to follow, what went just before this, the previous session, with this unbelievable information and approaches that employers have to mental health, to healthy minds. It's just really exciting to see what they're doing in the city of St. Paul and at Best Buy. And now we're going to talk about it from a little bit of a different angle on healthy minds. Every employee well-being is really a business strategy. It's very important for companies. They've learned that it really is, because a healthy, happy, and engaged workforce can reduce healthcare costs by, I read the statistic recently, $1,600 per employee in leave for disability, for other absences, and also for the related to their performance at work when they are at work. They call it presenteeism, although I haven't heard too much about that word lately is on presenteeism, but it really is. I love the word mindfulness at work. I think that's a better term than presenteeism. So we all understand the concept of employee well-being. We've heard about it. We know that there are certain components of well-being that now we can measure. We look at the different determinants of well-being as physical health, number one. So employers have put in many wellness programs. In fact, that was the first foray into healthy employees, was different types of wellness programs, risk assessments, biometric screenings, and so on. Weight loss programs. But now we know that emotional and psychological health is just as important and is just an important component of well-being, overall well-being. And then we know that social connections are extremely important. The isolated person can't possibly be totally happy unless they're a Buddhist monk somewhere up on a mountaintop. Financial health is becoming so well known as such an important factor of well-being. In fact, the anxiety having to do with financial stress that we'll actually talk about in this session is one of the most, the highest cause of the anxiety and the poor unwell-being, I guess I could say. And then life satisfaction, having meaning and purpose in life, or thinking that there's some meaning and purpose in your life, and finding satisfaction in just living, and then having engaging activities both at home and at work. Those are all some of the determinants of well-being. So what's often missing, though, when we talk about well-being and the concept, we understand it well, all these components, is how do you turn these concepts into action? So today's, the session right now is going to talk about, or talk to people and hear from people who are innovators in mindfulness and well-being. They're really smart people. I was reading all about their information. You'll get to hear about it. They're just really, we talk about innovators. This is really cool when you can actually take a concept and turn it into some practical solution that employers like Best Buy that you heard in City of St. Paul, and you'll hear from others this afternoon, that they're actually putting into practice. And that's the exciting part about it on the innovation. So we are going to talk about three major components of well-being that I mentioned, more than three. We're going to talk about happiness and engagement and at work. We're going to talk about financial wellness, and we're going to talk about social connections. And so we have three experts in these areas. I think what we'll start with, I was thinking about the comment that Dennis made this morning. He said that he has rarely met a happy person who is successful. So let's talk about happiness. And Ofer, would you like to start the discussion? I'm hoping that your slides are next in line here, so let's find out.
Yeah, I don't know, but I'm...
Nope, they're not. Hold it. Okay, here's a little preview. There we go. There you go. Tell us about happiness at work.
Yeah, so good morning. Maybe good afternoon. Good morning, Steph.
Oh, I didn't introduce you. I'm so sorry. I said I was going to introduce you. Sorry about the interruption. Over. Ofer Leidner is, you all have the bios, so I'm not going to read very much about it, but he is, what I said, a true innovator. He has, he brings to Happify his expertise in developing strategic partnerships and opportunities for rapid, healthy growth for technology companies on a global basis, and he's been involved with lots of different digital media businesses and a gaming company and a whole bunch of different things that he brings into the Happify. So,
yeah,
there you are.
Great. So, so good morning, everyone, and delighted to be here, and thanks for inviting us to kind of share our story about Happify and the inspiring crowd, as well as the stories that we heard both on, you know, the personal experience that Dennis had, and as well as the fantastic work that is being done in Minnesota. Just kind of, I think, sets the question of how do we go about doing, taking it to the next level and kind of addressing the challenges. And really, since we spent, I'm based in New York. I've been 5 years on the journey to essentially crack emotional health and really figure out how do we bring it to scale. I'll tell you a little bit about the background that is relevant. So prior to Happify Health, I spent a decade building a fairly large casual gaming company. And if you're familiar with casual games, you probably know that you are using them to the sometimes form of addiction. Think about the Farmville, the Candy Crushes of the world. And if you're not familiar, look at what your kids are doing on the screen. And that's kind of the decade before Happify. That's what I spent. And in that world, after realizing that we did one day a board presentation and calculated 19 billion hours a year that we got people to play these games on our platform, over 60 million people that were playing our games every month. There was an aha moment for us and said, what if we could take some of that engagement expertise that we have in design, habit formation loops, the games are no other than habit formation loop, and really bring them into this task of helping people live slightly better, slightly healthier lives. So we went on this journey to really try to bring the expertise in engagement design that we've had and build products that have been used by tens of millions of people and marry them with evidence-based interventions. You know, really got excited about the idea that scientists in the past 40 years have been working to find out ways to improve mental health from in an evidence-based practice, from CBT, positive psychology, mindfulness, all of these practices that have been studied extensively. And really kind of the journey starts with how we used to building solutions and products. We first took it to the consumer market. I got very quickly to realize that people are using this product. I had over 3.5 million people that have used the platform and the solution. And at that time, 3 years ago, I met this gentleman who's now the chairman of the company. He at the time was running Optum Specialty Networks and was overseeing the largest behavioral health company in the country. And he approached us and said, guys, I rarely see companies that crack both engagement and clinical outcomes, but you should totally focus on the market and work through health plans to the employers to solve these problems. So we've been ever in the past 3 years on the journey to essentially bring that solution that we have to health plans, employers, and we talked, and I think everybody in this audience recognized the challenges that workforces are dealing with, that employers are dealing with, both from a cultural point of view, any measurement of cost. It's good for business to address the mental health challenges, not just the moral obligation that I really believe that we have as people. But then the question is, okay, say we want to bring that and advance this agenda. We do know there's so many obstacles, and how do we address these obstacles? Access, time, stigma, cost, these are all challenges that every one of you is experiencing with their own community, with their own state, with employers. And the challenge that we took upon ourselves is to actually crack this challenges one after another, and we knew that we're going into a long journey. There is no shortcut. If you want to provide outcomes, if you want to measure everything, you need to kind of take the time and do it. So I want to be kind of intentional about the disruption dimension that we're kind of brought to this world and kind of the discoveries that we've had over the years. And we really kind of approaching it in a sense of trying to really bring solutions to the market that allows us to disseminate the know-how, the expertise to folks so that they can basically gain the benefit and improve their lives. So I think the first dimension of approach of innovation that we've taken is the idea that self-directed tools can be effective. We all think that if everybody had a time to see once a week their therapist on the couch, they would get the support. Reality is that people don't have time, they often don't have the money, they often don't have the access. People can't leave campus, can't leave, and really don't have the time. And often when they reach to the EAP for a solution, this is a crisis mode. And the question, can we actually address it ahead of the curve? So we were able to demonstrate through a lot of work that we've done on the 3.5 million people that we served at the beginning, and then through the work that we do with employers, that if you provide a really strong engagement software framework and on top of it layer evidence-based interventions, you can actually get pretty effective in treating depression, anxiety, hypertension, and also build preventative skills. We also kind of brought to play the idea that there are new science disciplines that are all evidence-based that have been sitting on shelves of the academic institutions for the past 20 to 40 years, depending if your CBT was probably entering its fourth decade, mindfulness probably 1,500 years, but only 10 or 20 years that people have started studied. Positive psychology, relatively new practice, but very strong outcomes. And we basically said, what if we brought this approach of taking all of these interventions and weave them into a framework that will go and test for clinical outcomes? Because we do know that the approach of treating pathologies, what's wrong with an individual, what's wrong with an employee, will get less engagement than if we ask an employee, how can you live better? What is working in your life? And this is a pathology that is treated through this new science and is very, very effective. The other approach that we brought, the idea, so we know in the employer world, we kind of like to think about well-being, wellness, one silo, and then the clinical behavioral health world. And what we know is that essentially this kind of continuum that we all kind of participating on is not a siloed kind of world. You could be totally fine and kind of work on your prevention and be in a thriving capacity. And I always like to say we're a phone call away from sliding into that on this continuum and really address and suddenly fall into a clinical environment. So what we are actually demonstrated through a lot of studies, outcome we published, peer reviewed, is that if you take an approach of a continuum and help people find the right entry point that they need on this continuum and support them if they slide into a greater need and provide the support, that's a very good approach. By the way, we're not, as a platform, we don't advocate for a single solution that solves it all. Mental health is a multi-tier approach. There's people that need higher touch interventions. There are people that have topics that technology and solutions like ours can't solve. In that case, find a way to really hand off and switch and be much more coordinated. And the implementations that we're doing with different employers and health plans are all kind of looking at multi-tier approach. Care for those who you can care through technology. Give them the solution. Put it in their hands, have them use it and engage with it. If you identify something that needs higher touch intervention, if somebody has a substance abuse, if somebody has a chronic mental illness, this is not a solution. You want them right away in front of a psychiatrist, in front of other resources. But it's a multi-tier approach that I think employers are going to see as kind of the most effective integrated approach between these providers. The last point is the idea that we're always thinking about, and that's a healthcare. Digital healthcare is just one example. We're always thinking about clinical intervention is something that has to be really boring, has to look in a certain way, it has to kind of feel like a program that you have to do. But what if inspirationally we can think about Mayo Clinic meet Pixar in terms of the experiences? I just kind of want to have you again digest what would happen to our engagement results in the healthcare industry if you can create clinically validated interventions that brings the Mayo Clinic rigor of science and Pixar in terms of user experience and unique experience. And that's exactly what we went out and built. So we are very innovative on the user experience. And that's kind of a core part of the disruption that we were bringing to market. Let me just quickly, so the platform itself, and I'm not going to spend too much time. We can talk later about it and happy to have this conversation. It's essentially a digital platform. It has over 60 different programs that really try to cater for the wide array of topics that people have. You could find people that would be directly identifying with their stress, anxiety, depression. You can find people that have problem with their teenage daughter that drives them really kind of to the point where they're kind of dealing with a lot of anxiety. 60 different programs that are kind of bringing that evidence-based practice to action in a very measurable way. The core kind of components of this approach is let's take these interventions that are out there on the shelf, spend time, work with the scientists, we collaborate with every important academic institution that have studied these interventions. Let's take this intervention, digitize them, and bring them into user experiences that create really fantastic experiences. Work with domain experts. So if we work, we talked a lot about population with chronic condition and comorbidity of emotional health. We would work with a cardiologist. We would work with a diabetes physician that understand the emotional aspect of this and bring it together onto this platform. So this is kind of like, you know, I like this chart because this is kind of what guides us every day. No matter what intervention that you have, whether you do it in person, through technology, there's a multiplier of engagement. And if you can't get engagement right, and engagement, we'll talk about what it means, but if you can't get people to actually get involved and do what you ask them to do, the outcome and impact is very little. And what you see here is just over 3 years of optimizing this platform, working with a lot of large employers that are dealing with large workforces, distributed locations, global challenges. You know, talking about mental health in Brazil is different than in France, and you need a solution that allows you to address global workforce. This is essentially some of the results that we're able to achieve. Liz from Best Buy, hats off on the 17% EFP, three times the highest that I've heard. It's incredible. But how can we take it to the next level? And how can we get 45, 50% of the workforce engaged on an ongoing basis with a platform? So we are now at, with all the employers that we work, 25 to 30% of the population. Any workforce that we work across industries, financial services, manufacturing, healthcare, all are seeing 25 to 30% activation rate. And retention, what we're trying to do is not deal with it as a one-time kind of solution. We're trying to cultivate a culture within the workforce that there's a destination and they can go and reach out to resources. And if you make the experience fun, if you make it something that they want to engage with, you would actually see the results and people are developing habitual use. So we have really high engagement in this. We can talk more about this, but we're heavily studied on the clinical side, peer-reviewed, published, really have done everything that needs to be done to be able to validate clinical outcomes, claims costs, disability. Our approach was, rather than going to the employers and say, you have all the data, we went to all of the people that are actually comprising this data. So when we want claims data, we work with the health plans. When we want to understand the impact of getting people faster back to work after disability, we work with a disability provider and studied what happened when people go on Happify and get the support, how fast can they go back on their feet faster. So this is kind of very well studied by now. We have really a robust solution for a large scale population health management on the emotional health side. That's pretty much it, you know.
That's exciting. It really is. Well, now let's talk about the financial stress side of well-being. And David Stedman is the CEO of Brightdime. He's the founder and CEO of the company. It's a leading financial wellness firm designed to create real behavioral change in employees through unbiased integrated financial platform coupled with concierge features of personalized coaching and content. David's got quite a career behind him in management roles at Goldman Sachs in New York, Barclays Capital, and hedge fund for about 12 years. So he's got tremendous financial background and experience. And what's interesting is that he's taken that knowledge and experience and put it into a very interesting platform. Tell us about the Bright Dime.
Thank you. It is great to be here. I guess a lot of you may be wondering, what's a financial guy, you know, Goldman Sachs, Barclays Capital in London, 20 years of financial experience, why would he be relevant to this crowd? I can tell you that I realized during my career, during that 20 years, that the resources, the financial resources, financial tools, the financial coaching that was out there, the very people that needed that were the actual people that did not have access to it. And so I completely changed my career, started Bright Dime. I'm CEO of Bright Dime, by the way, and we are a financial wellness company. And the idea of Bright Dime is just to help people. We don't sell any other products whatsoever. So why am I here? Well, I can guarantee that everybody in this room has had financial stress. I don't care if you're a multimillionaire or you're totally encumbered with debt, you have had financial stress. And the idea is that we need to get people on the right path to financial freedom. What a lot of people do is they'll go on the internet and they'll try to cure their single problem, and you'll see here, financial wellness is a lifelong journey, not a single destination. If you cure that one single problem, that's not looking at your holistic world. And so what we're trying to do is get people on the right path so that they have financial freedom for their lifetime. So, okay, getting on the right path, get a coach, talk to them about it, should be fairly easy, right? No. Life is very treacherous. There are tremendous obstacles out there. Let me see if I can, yes. These are just a few obstacles, challenges that people have. There are more statistics, but I think these are kind of tell the story. And I'm a math guy, so I love statistics, so please bear with me. Hopefully this won't bore you too much. But 24% of millennials are financially literate. Well, that means that 76% are not. 63% of people can't afford a $500 emergency. Their car breaks down. They can't afford that. One in three have saved nothing for retirement. Nearly a quarter of people's salary, these are American statistics, by the way, nearly a quarter of American salary go to paying down debt. And a big, big topic these days, student loans, there are a lot of articles out there, $1.3 trillion in outstanding student loans. It is frightening. And the obstacles are there. I mean, this scared the heck out of me. I hope it at least gets an eyebrow raised from you guys. It is something. So, okay, obviously there's a problem in America. I mean, the economy's good, unemployment's low. People still are living paycheck to paycheck. Now, that's a problem, but the real problem is it feeds into other health mental problems. If you have financial imbalance, I can promise you that you will have imbalance in your relationships, your work life. You'll also have imbalance in your health. And you can see all that in the middle, divorce, headaches, anxiety, depression, insomnia, whatever it may be, financial stress adds to that. And again, I'm coming out with statistics again. I love them, but again, it tells the story. One in four Americans have PTSD-like symptoms. 53% are anxious about money, 78% financially insecure, and about 75% of workplace accidents happen because of stress. Can anybody guess the number one cause of stress in America? Financial stress. That is it. And so that all seems like really, really bad news. And I don't want financial guy getting everybody down. Not what you came here for. But don't get sad. There are solutions out there. Bright Dime is just one, and I'm not here to talk all about Bright Dime. The important thing to hear, and I'll tell you about Bright Dime, but the important thing to know is that there are answers here. There really are. Bright Dime answer, I'm super, super biased. I think we've got the best program that's in the market today. You were talking about engagement and the user experience. It is exactly, we're doing the exact same thing. We look at engagement as important, but what we think is just as important is continued engagement. You know, I said it's a lifelong journey. It really is. So the way we do it, just to give you a quick summary, is we take a three-pronged approach. First is building self-awareness, holistic agnostic platform. That's self-awareness. We have automated budgeting for people. People can see where they're spending money, how they're spending it, what their debt situation is, what their investment situation is, a holistic view of their financial life so they can see where their issues are or where there may not be issues. That's great, but not by itself. It has to be combined with two other things. First is education. You'll hear a lot about the importance of education. We all do, whether it's mental health or financial. Educating people is super important. But one thing that we do that other people don't do is we don't believe in generic webinars or seminars. We believe that education needs to be targeted so you meet people where they are, so that the education we send out applies to that person. If somebody has zero balance in their checking account, we're going to send them information about emergency funds. So it's important to target it for that person. The last piece of this is coaching, and that's the most important point. Everybody, whether you're rich or poor, needs an ally to either bounce ideas off or help understand and walk them through their financial situation. I'll give you three quick examples. Take caller Jane. Jane contacted a Bright Dime coach, and she said, my employer's offering this. I don't think I need it, but I just wanted to check it out. And so the employer says, well, Jane, what are your goals? And Jane, you know, said, well, I want to buy a house in the next year. And he could see the Jane's platform and see that Jane was not in a position to do that. So what he did is set out a four-step plan for Jane to buy a house. He's going to follow up with her on each of these steps to position her over the next year to buy a house, improve the credit rating, save for a down payment. At the same time, he saw that Jane had several checking accounts and was getting fees in each of these accounts. He figured out a way to combine the accounts, and again, working with Jane, and saved her $300 just by doing that one little thing. Next story, call him Tom. Tom said, I need an advisor. Can you recommend one? One of the misnomers about financial wellness, especially with Bright Dime, is that we can be that advisor. Now, we're not an investment advisor where we're offering investment advice. That's not where the problems are these days. So Tom had a new baby, and he and his wife were scared. They didn't know if they were saving enough. They didn't know the cost. They were already thinking about college. All great. But if he had gone to a market investment advisor, it probably would have cost him several thousand dollars. Tom was actually in great shape. He just needed somebody to help walk him through how to budget for a new child. We talked to him about a 529 plan and how the benefits of investing in a 529 plan, all for Tom for free. And when Tom left, he felt financial freedom and he felt in control. He didn't need the traditional idea of an advisor. The last story I'll tell you, let's call him Kevin. Kevin, young lawyer, came to us with a very pointed question. I have student loan debt. I'm refinancing it. Should I refinance it for 10 or 15 years? And if it were me just face to face with Kevin, I would say, well, Kevin, if you can afford it, do it for 10 years. Well, the Bright Dime coach could see what Kevin's financial situation. He is armed with that information before they even start and can see that Kevin had major credit card debt. So what they did was, is they figured out, basically he recommended, let's do it for 15 years, but then they figured out the difference in the 10-year and the 15-year payment. And they created a goal in the Bright Dime platform to pay down the credit card by that amount each month until it was paid off. It's one size does not fit all, okay? So it's important to look at this holistically. And that is our approach. Our engagement numbers are, I think, the best in the industry, A, because we have no bias. Our only mission is to help the financial wellness of the employees, but also we personalize that user experience, I think, like no other. But it doesn't matter whether it's us or another firm. It's important that you understand that this is a big deal in the holistic view of wellness, okay? It doesn't matter whether it's Bright Dime or somebody else. Bright Dime is one part of that lane, that path. It's also, it goes right along with mental health and with physical health. If you want to help the holistic person, the holistic well-being, save the $1,600, $1,600 that Mary Ann was talking about, it's important to look at all this in a holistic way. And so financial health means people who are more resilient, less stressed, and confidently moving forward. Financially healthy people are engaged, effective, and satisfied employees. I thank everybody for having me here. It's a privilege, and I hope you'll bear with the boring financial guy, and I look forward to your questions.
Sounded pretty good to me. Now, let's talk about social connections, one of the key areas of components of well-being. And I think we underestimate how important social connections are. People who are locked into their Facebook or doing just their own gaming, the casual gaming that you were talking about, Ofer, probably are sacrificing a lot of social connections. We see that an awful lot, especially in the millennials. And so, with Dr. Jeremy Noble, a board certified in both internal medicine and preventive medicine, and a dual master's degree in public health and epidemiology, has quite a background in the clinical side of this, but he also has a business side to it. He serves as the medical director of the Northeast Business Group on Health, one of our sister coalitions in the snow-blanketed New York. And one of his works there is directing the Solutions Center, working with large self-insured employers on a lot of the major health issues, chronic conditions, diabetes, obesity, which we'll talk about this afternoon. And the goal of the center's work is to develop innovative approaches to managing these challenging conditions, as well as to identify patient engagement models, which is what you both were talking about, the engagement side of it, and care models and value-oriented payment models that sustain them. But in addition to doing all of that, he has founded the Unlonely group, or the Unlonely Project. And he's going to talk about that today. I'm very curious about the Unlonely, and I love the title Unlonely. It's instead of Friends Project, it's Unlonely.
Good. Well, thank you, Mary Ann. It's a pleasure to be here. And it's a coming out party, in a way, for me, to be able to speak about what we're doing at the Unlonely Project. As Mary Ann mentioned, I am on the faculty at Harvard and Harvard Medical School, have been there for quite a while, and also have had a grateful for the role I've had at the Northeast Business Group on Health as medical director, so I'm wearing that hat too. But today I'm here representing the Unlonely Project. And you know, this is on health and well-being, so I think one of the things we learned is gratitude's important for health and well-being, so I did want to start with a note of gratitude to Mike and Margaret for giving us space to talk about loneliness and social isolation as a major health issue. I think, you know, it's obviously already come up this morning. It'll continue to come up, I think, as we really grapple with what's required to support a healthy workplace. And also, thanks and gratitude to the Northeast Business Group on Health, and particularly Candace and Courtney, who are here, have been so supportive of what we're doing at the Unlonely Project. And third is, there are several people in the audience here I've worked with for decades around these kinds of issues. And I think what we're seeing now with a serious attention to loneliness and isolation is a recognition that it's not just a minor kind of not feeling great kind of thing, although there's growing evidence that it's significant mental health, physical health, and social health concern, possibly the biggest public health issue in the 21st century that we're not yet taking as seriously as we should and could. And I think the workplace is a tremendous opportunity for that. It is starting to get recognition. Harvard Business Review, kind of a go-to journal for people concerned with business, actually featured this as a cover story in September. And, it's the convergence of awareness on lots of levels. you know, the idea of, you know, what that social connection is fundamental to business, that we can't run our businesses if people don't connect with their peers, with their colleagues, with their customers, you know, with their advertisers, right? If you're not connecting, it's very hard to be effective in the workplace. Many things hold us back, but and we can talk about those, but obviously feeling like you belong in the workplace is a fundamental of workplace well-being. Many of the speakers have already addressed that. But the other growing awareness is that, you know, loneliness and social isolation has significant mental and physical health consequences. And I'll review some of those in our time together. But let's first start with, well, what is loneliness and what is social isolation? They're not the same. So loneliness is social isolation. I'll start with that. That's actually simpler. That's an objective state, right? I'm not around anyone, maybe because of a rural situation, or maybe you live alone or you're working alone. More and more people are choosing that as a path. So there's a lot of just objective isolation. Loneliness is something different. It's actually a subjective assessment we make about the gap between the social connections we would like to have and what we actually have. So in a way, it's an interpretation that an individual makes of a social condition or circumstance. It's not an illness. It's not depression. But arguably, it's the single biggest risk factor for depression we can do something about. And so I think it merits attention for that reason. It's also incredibly common. We won't do a show of hands about who's been significantly lonely in their lives, but I can tell you the research shows it's between 65 and 70%. And the research also shows that one in three of us are significantly lonely right now. So we're obviously not isolated. Look at this room full of people. But one in three of us doesn't feel really that we're connected the way we'd like to be. We belong the way we would like to be. We have the kind of the social interactions we'd like to have. So this is important. If you think about a workplace, if one in three of your employees are not, and managers and leaders are not bringing their best selves to work as connected as they could be, you have a problem. So what are the new insights? More prevalent than I managed, as I said, 65% ever experienced, 50% experienced loneliness in public lives, right? So they're connected at home, but as soon as they leave the home, there's a kind of vulnerability of disconnection. And as I said, 35% are currently feeling lonely. Now, the other important thing is that all the factors driving loneliness, as far as we can identify and measure them, are increasing, which is why I think it's legitimate to call it a crisis. Some call it an epidemic. So what are the factors? So one is geographic migration. This is just isolation, whether it's for political reasons, economic opportunity reasons. Across the world, people are leaving their places of origin, literally their homes, in order to seek better lives for themselves and their families, driven by economic lifestyle requirements. The second is growing diversity in our societies. We won't go, you know, we won't do the deep dive into what's going on politically, not just in the US, but around the country. But we see a growing sense of distrust for others and uncertainty about kind of our own ability to navigate our needs in society, and that sense of polarization based on a number of factors, race, gender, sexual preference, but it could even be increasingly political opinion or some other factor, right? So the sociologists are saying, hey, this is a trend, not a fad, unfortunately, and it seems to be continuing. The last, and we talked a little bit about the earlier session, is we are now changing the way we spend our time getting sensory input, informational input, and we're getting it digitally, we're getting it continuously. On our screens, we talked about that, whether it's social media or some other addiction to news feeds or some other way to be connected to the world and make sense of it. So, you know, these things come together as worrisome considerations driving things forward. So, but let's talk about the workplace and why does it matter? So, mental health. Let's start with that. So, as I mentioned, loneliness, isolation, clearly risk factors for the kind of well-accepted triad of mental health concerns, depression, substance abuse, and suicide. You can make the argument that if that's all it was, that would still be big enough for employers to care and should care, and in fact do care. But wait, there's more. Okay. So physical health. We think about loneliness as a mental health issue, but growing and very worrisome epidemiologic studies show, and I'll share some of that in a minute, that it actually, for a number of reasons, Sean, you may have some insight into this also, the lonely brain actually triggers, maybe because of fight or flight, maybe because of other things, a cascade of neurophysiologic response that is pro-inflammatory, means it increases the inflammatory response, which is a root cause for cardiovascular disease, other kind of musculoskeletal disorders, and it reduces immune system capability, which means it increases risk for oncology. So loneliness and isolation won't just make you miserable, but it will kill you, and I'll share some worrisome data on that. And last is performance, right? So engagement in the workplace, engagement with peers and others, ability to collaborate, and citizenship. So that's kind of what most employers, whether they're public sector or private sector, are in business to do. So let's look at some of this kind of worrisome epidemiology coming out. So this was done by Julianne Holt-Lunstad at Brigham Young. This is just published this as one of several papers that have come out in the last several years. Obviously, you can't read the fine print here, so what I'll do is I'll kind of talk it through a little bit. This top line and the x-axis here is excess mortality, so the increased risk of dying early. So if you have social connection deficit, the increased risk, you know, for all the, you know, serious social connection deficit is pretty significant. In her studies, it's as much as 70%, meaning you have a 70% increased risk of dying early simply because you don't have the social connections you'd like to have. I don't think anyone realized that level of magnitude. But let's put it in perspective of other things we take seriously in public health, like smoking. So there's the risk for smoking cigarettes, there's the risk for alcohol consumption, physical activity, and obesity, right? So, as I said, not only will it make you miserable, but there's evidence it will kill you. The soundbite that's now kind of been captured by media is that being lonely is like smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And when I say that, people are, that's the reaction. But it's only because we haven't connected the dots. And it's not because, you know, loneliness has changed and become more toxic. It's just we understand its toxicity better. So I think that merits the crisis. So, or the label of crisis. So what are we doing about it? So the Unlonely Project got started 2 years ago with a coalition that included employers, but there's a lot of loneliness out there and a lot of at-risk groups. So we also do work with older adults and people who care about older adults, where it's a combination of both physical isolation often, but even simple things like hearing impairment, right, which is prevalent in older adults, starts reducing your ability to be socially interactive. So older adults, and then it turns out almost anyone with a chronic or serious illness tends to withdraw a little bit as they address those concerns. So we all often think about the devastating illnesses like cancer or neuromuscular disorders like ALS, MS, and so forth, for sure. But there are a whole host of other chronic illnesses, everything from diabetes to inflammatory bowel disease to cardiovascular disease, that kind of make you feel like you don't fit in. You're different, you have needs and concerns that don't put you into the normal interaction with other people. So we launched the Unlonely Project, really with a coalition of people who cared about, you know, all these populations at risk. And that list goes on to include veterans, multi-deployment, post 9/11 veterans, adolescents, college campuses, and so on. And a threefold mission for the Unlonely Project. First is to create more awareness of the issue, the complexity of the issue and the significance of the issue, so that's part of why I'm delighted to be here today, but very importantly, to start looking at innovative programming approaches and also research, so we can actually get smarter and more effective at putting solution sets out there, not just in the workplace, but more broadly. And these solution sets start mapping into the kind of programs employers feel very comfortable with in general. So it starts by attracting people. I actually think the stigma around loneliness is as high, if not higher, for many people than mental illness, in part because of the heroic work over the last 15 or 20 years to destigmatize mental illness. So I work in a college university setting. Our students are very willing to talk about their depression, their bipolar disease. It's quite remarkable. This would never have happened 10 years ago, but no one wants to say they're lonely. Right, so we've got to get people to feel a little more comfortable just acknowledging it as the common social experience it is. So first you have to attract and then engage people on a difficult topic, but then you have to activate them. What is it that allows you to connect and bridge to others? And the most powerful thing we've come up with so far, and I hope it resonates for people, is what really allows us to connect to other people is the authentic sharing of who we are to someone who is actively listening and willing to share back. So programmatically, there are a lot of models of how you can do that: narrative creation, narrative, you know, storytelling expansion. But it's so powerful. Even in the presentations we've already had today, anytime someone is willing to step up and share a personal story, often at the risk of embarrassment or shame or other negative emotions, we all know that we feel drawn to that story, in part because there's just a legitimate, empathetic, compassionate connection. We're all human beings struggling with very similar challenges around the need to connect to others. And to be able to articulate your story in a safe, secure environment to someone who is actively listening and receptive to that story can be a game changer. And there are many models for doing that: digital, interactive, face-to-face, and we're experimenting with all of them. In fact, I'm just delighted to hear more about Happify and some of you doing what you're doing. It clearly, you know, it's part of where this is all going. But then it also has to, so once you activate and engage, fantastic, but you have to support people. And I just want to call out one feature of Brightdime, because I think, for me, when I listen to that, one of the most compelling things is you actually put people together with an active coach who'll pay attention to your pain, your challenge with financial stuff, not make you feel guilty about it, not make you say, oh, okay, you don't even know what this is or that, but connect. And so that part of support seems to be what makes the difference. And then we address loneliness. So that's the arc of experience. And so what are we doing to get the word out? So one of the fun things we're doing, this is an idea that one of our millennials came up with. Well, if you want people to pay attention to a new idea in the modern world, you have to have a film festival. So he said, what? A film festival on a topic no one wants to pay attention to? And she said, to her credit, if you do it online, everyone will come, because there's safety and security. And so we said, great, let's give it a shot. So last May, we launched our first effort at this. It's the and it's online now. I passed around some posters. You see it out there. It has this kind of picture of the Unlonely Project on one side. And then we got so excited about being on the way to 1 million views that we actually are doing it again. And so you come to the Unlonely Film Festival, and it's a chance to actually find stories other people are willing to share with the power of short film — it's all short film — and resonate with that and feel less alone. Now this year, when we launch, we're gonna do even more, right? So it's not just see a film, but learn more about loneliness, learn more about connection and so on. So that's our active engagement platform. I think through the magic of technology, we can actually, since you weren't with us at the launch last year, I think we can show a 1 minute clip on that.
Loneliness is really the discrepancy, it's the difference between desired and actual social relationships.
The Online Film Festival is actually a part of the Unloneliness Project, and it's all part of the work of the Foundation for Art and Healing, whose mission is to explore and promote a very simple but powerful idea that creative expression can improve health and well-being for individuals and communities.
These are not professional filmmakers. You guys are out there doing it with peanuts. But it doesn't stop creativity, and when you have important stories to share, telling your story, no matter how dark, no matter how deep, is, as in Oprah's words, cathartic.
So in these short films we saw today, it was more than any paper I've ever written. I can read a scientific paper, but this really put it all into words very clearly.
Loneliness and isolation is one of the most important risk factors in our society today, and yet it's a great secret. Connecting with people could be the most important thing we could do to support the health and well-being of our people.
By sharing our stories, we can not only connect with each other, but ourselves. I think it's just right on the mark.
So come see our films, be unlonely with us, and I'll end with gratitude, and thanks for listening.
I love it. Great. We have only about 5 more minutes left, and I just have one question, and then I'll open it to those in the audience who have questions. I have a whole slew of questions, but I'll use only one. I'm thinking about, I put it on the benefits manager's hat, and I'm thinking about all of the things we're seeing today, all of the exhibitors today, sponsors, and your stories, and I can just imagine that I know that we have a lot of benefits executives here from various companies in Dallas and around the country, Minnesota too. And how can a benefits manager integrate all of, for example, Happify or the Lonely Project or Bright Dime or some of these other really cool, innovative ways to deal with different aspects of wellness? How are you connected with health plans? Because so many of them rely on the health plans to be kind of the be-all, do-all for us, because they don't have the bandwidth, the benefits managers don't have, in some companies, the bandwidth to deal with a lot of different vendors. Some do. Talk to me a little bit about how you take your innovative products or services and put it into for benefits company, for a benefits manager at a company.
Maybe I can start, because obviously we're not a company. I think it's a couple things. First is take these issues seriously and start developing measurement systems. So for instance, financial literacy. Survey your employed population so if you know it's a problem, you can actually deploy a solution against it. Same with happiness, and we're actually doing that with loneliness and isolation. We have a 3-question screener, and we're putting it out there to you. So first, measurement, then accountability. Right? So if you hire a vendor to deal with a problem you've been able to measure, hold that vendor accountable and hold yourselves accountable to making a difference.
Good suggestion.
I'll add that, first of all, I agree 100%. And it's, accountability is critical. It's also critical that there are measurements to there's data to measure the ROI of that investment. ROI investing in wellness, ROI is always comes into question. But these days, we're starting to be able to measure it a lot better. And we have our own measurements. We have a way to show that ROI. But it's important that no matter what your vendor is in wellness, that you can measure the ROI. As far as integration goes, you know, for us, for our company, we can customize the integration for the company, whether it's as a standalone product that their employees have access to or integrated with their entire HR system. So for us, it's not that hard to integrate it, and so we try to customize it for the single company.
Okay. How about you, Oliver?
Yeah, I think we heard here about, first of all, the multiple dimensions of well-being, being financial, you know, physical and emotional. Mm-hmm. So by definition, anyone that wants to play needs to be able to exchange and be integrated into existing ecosystems. The belief that you know, you're coming as a standalone point solution is just not relevant anymore in my point of view. So I would, we're integrated into health plans. We're working directly with employers, integrated into their wellness offering. There's even some on this crowd that we're on the side that we're partners of. And I think it's all about kind of making sure that you create the best employee experience. And I would encourage you to invite your vendors, and this could be anyone that involved in supporting, to share data, to start kind of optimizing the experience. I can't stress enough how better the overall outcome for the employees would be if you would start sharing that data, and ultimately within the, you know, HIPAA limitations. But if we are seeing someone on our platform that is in need, the core stress is financial, I don't see a reason why this shouldn't be on a platform like yours. Or if we see someone that on our platform, and we're detecting a lot of these core reasons on the platform, if we see someone that is in need of different service, right away, hand off, make sure that that person gets the best. And it's almost like optimize globally, not locally, and then you get best outcomes. Mm-hmm.
And that's the common theme that I hear from what you've been describing, all three of you, is the customization and the consumerization of the different approaches that you have. So it doesn't matter what age or what industry or what group, diverse group you're in, you can apply what you have because it all kind of connects. Technology is a wonderful thing, isn't it? How about a question or two from the audience, anyone in particular?
I just want to tell how much I appreciate I don't think I need this. I think I'm loud enough. No, I'm joking. But I want to talk to you about Happify, and I like hearing that you guys are willing to try to work with employers whatever way possible. What we've done the last 2 years, I think I mentioned when I was up there, every 2 years we focus on something. The past 2 years was preventing the onset of full-blown diabetes and catching folks in the pre-diabetic state. We've worked with a company that has been incredibly successful in engaging with our people, and engagement is, you know, many folks talked about engagement. If you don't get them engaged, whatever great thing you have to offer. So I've been looking for who can be that amazing engagement vehicle for us when we move on to mental health in the next couple of years. So I'd love to talk with you more and see. Maybe that'll work.
Well, another question?
Okay. Well, the good news is it's lunchtime. And the other good news is that our speakers here for this particular session will be here for lunch, I hope. And we'll be able to talk with you a little bit further in this. So thank you, Jeremy, for your information on the Unlonely Project. Thank you, Ofer, for yours on the brilliant platform that you've described in Happify. And David, thank you so much for your Bright Dime information.
Thank you. Round of applause. Thank you, everyone.